This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 20 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are going to have a third round of Nicholas Meyer goodness, this time looking at his new miniseries for television, which just aired a couple weeks ago, and that is Houdini. So we'll just get this thing started. Now, this is a television, well, I guess it is a miniseries technically.
It is what they call a biopic.
Yeah.
Despite being a biopics.
Yes. And it is about basically the life of Houdini, but it's taking sort of a an interesting approach to it, where there's a lot dealing with his relationship with his wife and his relationship with his mom.
Yeah.
And just kind of like looking at how that sort of influenced what it was that he did publicly.
Yeah. I thought the first part was really weird, and then the second part, that was actually really helpful, because I wasn't paying attention to the beginning when I started it. And the second one, I was like, oh, it's based on a book that has, like a psychoanalytic...
Yes.
I can't remember the name of the book. But it's, like, very, very Freudian.
Yeah, it's based on a book which was a psychoanalysis.
A psychoanalytic portrait.
Yes. That's it. Which is something that I guess this author did, Bernard C. Meyer is his name, and he is, amongst other things, the father of Nicholas Meyer, who wrote the miniseries.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting. But I guess, like, you know, kind of like looking at what Meyer Sr. has done, I know that he was a psychiatrist. And that was his sort of main gig, but he did...
Psychiatrist or psychologist?
Psychiatrist. Yeah. Okay. And that was his main gig, but he did do a lot of writing. And his most famous work, like, I don't know if he did like a series of these or just a couple of them, but there's one for Joseph Conrad.
Yeah, now I'm remembering, because we talked about this on one of them.
Well, we didn't really talk about it that much, but it might have been in the book that Meyer wrote, The View from the Bridge. So that's kind of interesting. Another kind of interesting little Star Trek parental connection is that one of the executive producers on this piece is Gerald W. Abrams, who is the father of J.J. Abrams.
Yep.
And I do remember from something, somewhere, that Gerald W. Abrams and Nicholas Meyer are friends, because I remember at some point there was an interview, I think, with J.J., where they were talking to him, and he was saying that, you know, oh, my dad was friends with Nicholas Meyer back in the day. I remember going to Meyer's house when I was a kid and stuff. So...
He had a whole bunch of really cool things in his house, and I thought, I would like to break some of these.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. So yeah, that's kind of a cool little thing. But I guess let's get into the miniseries on the whole first, because there's some interesting stuff here. Now, yeah, the reason why we're talking about this is because it was written by Meyer. It wasn't directed by him. It was directed by a guy named Uli Edel, or Edel, E-D-E-L, Adele?
I pronounce it like Eden, but with an L. Edel.
Edel. Okay, Uli Edel.
That's probably not accurate, but who cares? It's a name.
He has directed numerous things in the past. He's had a pretty big career. I know he's been nominated for a DGA award for Rasputin, and he's been, I think he made a movie which was nominated for Best Foreign Film a couple of years ago. He was also nominated for a Razzie for Body of Evidence. But he has directed a lot of stuff for television as well as film. Some of the TV shows that he's worked on are Oz, Homicide, Twin Peaks, so Tales from the Crypt. So yeah, he's done.
So lots he's been of stuff. He's been around for a while.
Yeah. So what did you think about this movie?
It's weird. Generally speaking, biopics are sort of a tricky thing, and there are a lot of different ways to get it wrong. I was actually rather impressed by it, you know, for a lot of things, but for the most part, the idea that the History Channel produced this thing is very surprising.
It's a whole new world out there in the realm of basic cable.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of crazy to think, like, this isn't just a cheapo one-off. I mean,
no, they took it for real. This is serious.
Like you just look at some of the other people involved. I mean, Adrian Brody, of course. I mean, that dude's won an Oscar. So you stick him in something, and that's crazy. But, like, for example, Carl Walter Lindelob was the cinematographer. Like, he's, you know, the guy who shot Chronicles of Narnia, and
okay.
I mean, like, he's done. He's shot Independence Day, you know.
Okay,
he shot.
Has he shot a good movie?
My point here.
Okay,
my point here is that he is a very well established guy, yeah, who they will give millions and millions of dollars worth of responsibility to.
Yeah,
you know, he's not just some random dude who they pulled off the street.
No, you can criticize a lot of the people in their past. Certainly Adrian Brody, he's made some awful movies,
but he's also made some good movies.
But yeah, he's made maybe at least one. But no matter what the track record of the people involved, they were expensive people.
Yeah, it's very high end. This is an A-list production, you know.
Yes.
Maybe not quite at, like, HBO level, but certainly at, like, AMC level.
Yeah. There are a lot of surprising things about the scale and motivation, intention, purpose. They were doing something that you would not expect the History Channel to be doing. And they did it in a way that was surprisingly well handled.
Yeah.
I would not have expected the History Channel's biopic miniseries on Houdini to actually be only really bad on the levels that most things are. Because it is not cheap, it is not sloppy. It's like, this is a big, polished movie. If this was in theaters, no one would be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't feel out of place. It would feel long,
yeah.
Repetitive.
It's interesting. I mean, on the whole, I thought it was very good, but in a very sort of unique way. The style.
That's a qualifier. Whatever. That's a good one.
What I'm saying is, like, you know, you hear that there's going to be a Houdini biopic on the History Channel, written by Nicholas Meyer, and you get a certain image in your head, especially when they throw people like Adrian Brody in the mix. You're like, okay, I think I have an idea of what that's going to look like. I think it's probably going to look like, say, Time After Time or something like that. I mean, obviously it's, you know, a kind of a different time period, but that sort of, you know, like reserved classical style. And that's not what this is at all. It is very much
considering the director, it is very modern.
It's extremely modern. Yeah. It's, you know what it feels like? I kept on thinking about this, and
feels a little too modern.
This is going to be like a kind of a weird comparison to make, but I kept on thinking that it felt like an episode of that show with Howie Mandel. Was it called Deal or No Deal? The game show thing?
Yeah.
Like, I always saw the end of it because it was on, like, right before Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
That's funny because I remember the Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip episode where they parodied the show.
Yeah.
Which is how I understand how the show worked. But oh, and like, the 30 Rock parody where there was a briefcase filled with gold.
But it's like kind of a weird... I mean, that show was really weird because it's like your typical game show where it's like, are you going to open the case or not? Oh, we're going to give you a deal. But the way that it's done is it's like the most dramatic thing ever in the history of drama, you know, where it's like...
Yeah, it's like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with the unbelievable music cues, like, lighting. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
You know, and then like the camera's like zooming in on the people and it's like, are you going to do it? Oh, we're getting a call from upstairs. And then you look upstairs and you see someone walking around, but you just see their silhouette and like a command center and everything. And like the music is just like, dun, 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 dun. Oh my God, this is so intense. When in reality, it's just like people sitting around like a room talking to each other.
Yeah, and then there's like one guy upstairs in a bathrobe with a coffee mug behind some frosted glass.
And there's some like weird, you know, quick editing and everything like that. That's how this movie felt. And it was almost like I got the impression, I mean, who knows for sure? I'm not saying that this is what happened, but like you look at the way that it was shot and the way that it's written and everything like that. And I mean, a big key to this whole thing is the music, which is by another Star Trek veteran, by the way, John Debney, and another high profile filmmaker, John Debney. He did the music for Pegasus in Next Gen. That's the only Star Trek episode that he did. But like these days, he's known for doing things like Iron Man 2, Predators, Doctor Who. He's done some stuff. Really? He did Sin City. He's done tons of things, tons and tons of movies. From like all genres and everything like that, he's very highly sought after. He's got like 10 projects in the works right now. It's very cool, and I mean he has done things like this before. You know, he did that Bonnie and Clyde miniseries. He did the Hatfields and McCoys miniseries. But even then, like those two things were super high profile, and you know, so they grab like the guy who's known for doing those types of miniseries. It's very interesting, but that the music in it is so weird in that it's very, very, it's almost like Hans Zimmer-y, like when Hans Zimmer is doing like the crazy stuff with like electric guitars and synthesizers and stuff. It's very strange stylistically. I kind of got the impression watching it, and again, this is what I was getting at. I wonder how much of it was changed in the editing room. I mean, like, we do these exercises when you go to film school and they teach you editing, you know, and stuff like that, where they say, like, here's a bunch of raw footage, cut this scene together. And then, you know, you get, like, if there's 20 people in the class, you'll get, like, 18 edits which are exactly the same, and then you'll get one which is really good, and then another one which is just really weird and completely different from what you know was intended. And watching this thing, I'm like, there's no real reason why they couldn't have cut this movie together in a different way to make it play much more classically. And you know, you throw out the Debney score and you hire someone like John Williams or someone to come in and write something more along the lines of what you'd find in, say, Lincoln. And then all of a sudden, you've got a movie which is geared more towards the Masterpiece Theater crowd than towards the Deal or No Deal crowd. You know what I mean?
I think... Yeah, I know what you mean, but I don't think that that is the thing that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm I'm torn in watching it. I'm like, did they? I have a feeling that's what was going on in Nicholas Meyer's head when he was writing it. And, you know, I'm very curious to know what Nicholas Meyer...
What do you mean? What was going on in his head when he was writing
it? Like, I think when Nicholas Meyer was writing this script, you know, being a filmmaker himself, I'm sure that he had a certain idea of what type of movie it would be, right? You sort of visualize it in your head.
Yeah.
I don't think this is what he visualized. I mean, obviously, I don't know for sure.
You see, this is the thing. I kind of think the thing that you're describing, this weird... Let's just describe what we're talking about. This movie doesn't... I'm just going to call it a movie because that's easier.
Fine.
All right, this thing, it has a weird temporal component in that in scenes that don't seem like they deserve loud and fast-paced,
yeah,
intense music and editing. That stuff is there.
Yeah.
But the thing is, those sequences, those moments where it becomes this weird, where that little bit of like music video energy is awakened.
Mm-hmm.
They're all about things that the movie and the filmmakers are trying to connect directly to who Harry Houdini was. What yeah. made him what he was? What is his like spiritual DNA, and how it led through how this particular like whatever the abstract concept is that's being depicted in this scene, how it guided his entire existence, even including to the moment of his death.
Yeah,
and in some cases even beyond, like that is in this on a regular basis, and that doesn't seem all that surprising because like that is kind of what it is. I mean, like, it is sort of like the whole point of like the psychoanalytic portrait. It's like, yeah, basically this entire thing is, this is who Harry Houdini was and this is why. And that why, because it's part of like the entire thing, means that you're constantly connecting this to everything. So every moment, even the little mundane moments, if they are in some way telling moments, they are... for the subjective like view on Harry Houdini, pretty much the most important things that could be talked about. So yeah, they're going to have an intense score because this right here is part of who he was, why he was the way he was, and if you took it out, he would be an entirely different person, and he probably would have died in a different place under different circumstances, and probably wouldn't have had such an embarrassing death.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think that all of that stuff is completely appropriate for this, and I think that it's well done, and, you know, I think that also what it does is kind of give modern-day audiences, people who were sort of raised in the MTV generation, a sense of what Houdini was to the people of, you know, the early 1900s, you know? It in a sense, through the style, kind of captured the spirit of Houdini back then.
Well, I mean, really? Yeah. I don't think that the people back then thought of Houdini as a man with, like, psychological issues
I'm not talking about the psychoanalytical portrait of him. I'm talking about the sort of spectacle behind his presentations and everything like that. I mean, these days, it's like, oh, you know, we're going to show a trick where somebody is on one side of a wall, and then we're going to put up a curtain, and then we're going to take the curtain down, and he's gone to the other side of the wall, and, you know, wow, how did he do that? That's amazing, right? And it's like, that doesn't fly these days. But if you present it in a certain way, if you present the movie in a certain way, the movie sort of becomes like a proxy for the spectacle of his shows and his persona back in 1900 or whenever.
I guess. I think that seems a little... I don't think that works. I mean, I don't think that's accurate.
Okay.
Like, I think that, like, what happened is that the subject was chosen, and upon depicting some of those moments, it was, well, like, you know, even on paper, you realize, oh, this is boring. We need to not make this book or movie and come up with a better approach. Like, the psychoanalytic portrait thing is, like, that to me, I think, is the crux of why it works, because a straight biopic of Harry Houdini would not be particularly exciting. Because he actually, despite having a really bizarre psychology, weird history, he was actually kind of strangely mentally healthy and not particularly troubled. Like, he had some problems, but, like, compared to even a mundane politician, seemed bizarrely mentally healthy and had a relatively uneventful life.
Yeah, yeah.
Behind the curtain, he was, okay, yeah, I'll pick up, no, I'll pick up the, I'll pick up the eggs on the, I'm just gonna go, I'm covered in chains, sweetie, I will be home at, like, 9.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just one of those things, you hear these stories, you see these things, and these alternate edits of movies and stuff like that, where they drastically change them. I mean, you know, the one that comes to mind is, say, Brazil. But there's even times where there's just, like, they replace the score, and it's like, wow, that's different. You know, like Legend, for example, or something. And it's like, wow, this is changing the movie.
They changed the score to Legend?
Yeah, like the one that was in theaters was by Tangerine Dream, right?
So just Ridley Scott, for just a couple movies in a row, just decided to have two scores. And
yeah, Jerry Goldsmith wrote really the original score. So
it's really weird. I forgot. I didn't know the Legend. Because, I mean, obviously we know about Blade Runner thing, but
yeah,
like, that's... Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Because, the director's cut of Legend has the Jerry Goldsmith score, if I'm not mistaken.
He's like, this worked great on Legend. Let's try it again.
Yeah.
Well, this is fun.
So that's just kind of a weird thing. I'd like to see what the first cut of this movie was. I'd be very curious to see the first cut of Houdini. Maybe there wouldn't be a difference. But
I don't think this was an editorial choice. It's adapted from a book that basically informs you exactly why it's done that way.
There is stuff in there which, you know, you could see. That, I mean, there's the whole thing where there's this sort of repeated theme of him getting punched in the stomach, right?
Yes.
Which at first I thought was really weird, but then when I got to the end of it, I was like, oh, okay.
You didn't know how Houdini died?
No, I didn't know how Houdini died.
Really?
No. Why would I know that?
What was it? Was it his appendix? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't actually think it was the punch.
Yeah. Oh.
I think that exacerbated things.
Mm-hmm.
But he should have canceled the show and gone to a hospital.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that he was punched.
Yeah. So, let's talk about the cast a little bit, because it's kind of cool. I mean, you got Adrien Brody in there, who was, you know, an Oscar winner. And, you know, the other person who was kind of really a standout to me, and someone who I had never really paid attention to up until about a week ago, is Kristen Connolly, who plays his wife. The first time I had ever noticed her, at least, was in Cabin in the Woods. And then a few weeks ago, I was watching the first episode of House of Cards. I'm like, who is that woman? She looks really familiar. And now here she is. She popped up again. I'm like, who is that woman? She looks really familiar. And it's like, seems to be a pretty big up-and-coming actress, and she's really, really good.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, the cast in this movie, I think, is very solid. Obviously, Adrien Brody is really good. Kind of a weird thing for him to do when you think about it, but I guess that's sort of like what's happening these days. You know, they're getting big name stars to come in and do television shows, and I think sort of in a way, the networks are thinking that this will lend a certain amount of legitimacy to their program, you know? I mean, it's very strange to think that we are living in a world where Halle Berry is doing, like, a science fiction show on CBS.
I'm sorry to inform you on this, but that is not the direction that this is flowing.
Okay. Well,
it's the collapse of the American economy and actors trying to get steady work because television is an ongoing paycheck.
Maybe, but not in this case. You know, not in this case. I mean,
no, but like there's definitely an argument because like while Halle Berry is doing this thing, he also did some other TV stuff, and part of it was to be get like essentially networked in this other community.
Yeah,
like it is a very weird environment right now economically, and it's in some ways it's helpful for the audience because we get amazing people doing these things, and it's sad in other ways because it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Now there is one other interesting thing in this movie that I specifically wanted to touch on. Because, for one thing, I think it's kind of the most interesting thing in the movie, but also because it very much ties into everything else that we've looked at in regards to Nicholas Meyer and his work.
Okay, let's talk about Adrian Brody's abs.
And that is...
What's with them? I mean, he's clearly fit, but what is with those abs?
And that, of course, is the interaction between Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. This I found to be very bizarre.
E.g., how their abs are similar.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a whole sequence in this movie where Doyle sees a show, and he's amazed by it. And Houdini is obviously a very big fan of Doyle. And Doyle and his wife come backstage. At that point in time, he is a big fan of Doyle. They're saying like, oh my God.
Okay.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
We're doing this.
Okay.
That was my reaction to this part of the miniseries. I was like, really? Are we doing this?
See, to me, it's interesting because, you know, when they first did it, I thought it was just going to be like a one-off scene.
No, it's like, I mean, well, really?
Now I know because...
I mean, you didn't. I find a way that you didn't know about that, like the seance thing.
I'm not
thing.
Big on Houdini and his life. I knew that Houdini spent, you know, a good portion of his career trying to debunk mystics, but I didn't know that Arthur Conan Doyle's wife was one of them. I didn't know that they had all these interactions with each other. I'm not really a huge Houdini fan.
Well, neither am I. But I mean, like, I've heard the story. I mean, I don't know where exactly, but like. I don't know. I feel like I've seen this reenacted like 9 times.
Yeah, I've never seen it. But what happened anyway, for those people who don't know, is in the movie, at least, Doyle and his wife come backstage, and Doyle is like, oh my God.
Bro, that was so off the hook. I totally went in on that.
I can't. You totally okay. Anyway, and he says, you know, that you walked through the wall, and you know, I've studied it. I looked at the stage and everything like that, and I've determined that the only way that you could have done that was through the use of like straight up real magic.
Mm-hmm.
And Houdini is like, what? The guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes, which is like the most logical and best example of like deductive reasoning like ever in the history of like literature, is not willing to accept that I like just tricked him.
What happened is that he saw something he didn't understand. He's like, I always understand everything. Obviously, he's a sorcerer.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if I were opposed to black magic, I would totally burn him as a witch.
But as it turns out, I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, it's just a different place. I mean, like, you know, if he lived in Boston, it would be a whole different deal.
Yeah. So that was very strange. And I thought, like, that's a really cool scene. And it really does kind of, like, speak to the idea of celebrity and stuff like that. And... you know, the thing that happens where, you know, you idolize someone and then you meet them in person and you realize that, you know, they're an idiot or a jackass or whatever. And I mean, that's something which...
I think, that episode of Growing Pains where Ben met that guy from that band.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but I mean, I know what
Growing Pains is. I barely remember what it is.
But, you know, But yeah, I mean, that kind of thing. And that's obviously something which everyone, you know, deals with. It's just sort of like something. But I'm like, that's really kind of cool that they did that here. And it's also kind of weird that Meyer, who obviously idolizes the work of Doyle a lot, would kind of put this in that thing. But then it kept on going. No, I mean,
but like it's a chapter in Doyle's life as well that informs him. Like, I mean, like it's part of the picture of Doyle that we have, that this episode occurred. Yeah. Without it, like...
And Meyer is the type of person who's smart enough to know that, you know, painting an entire portrait of someone, the good and the bad, is ultimately much more beneficial than just sort of, you know, whitewashing something or whatever. You know what I mean? So...
Yeah. I mean, like, it's I mean, in many ways, it's not even a question of being beneficial. I mean, essentially, by making the guy flawed, all the amazing things that he did are that much more impressive because they're like, he really did them.
Yeah.
He was really just like actually that good. Like, he's not like a mythic figure that like a bunch of, he's not Homer. He's not like 1,000 different guys over the course of 200 years. And like, it's all been attributed to one random dude. Like, this is a guy who actually did like a lot of amazing things. And we know that because his mistakes are on record.
Yeah. Yeah. But I thought it was a really interesting chapter in the movie. And then the way that it kind of, you know, turns and becomes, you know, a different part of his life after his mother dies and his sort of like goals in life are altered. And it is kind of cool, you know, especially since, you know, we just read a few, well, at this point, I guess it was over a year ago, we read the Houdini and Lovecraft book that Ron Wilkerson wrote. And basically, like, that kind of picks up where this movie sort of leaves off, like about when there's probably like a half an hour left in this movie is probably right around the time that Houdini and Lovecraft is taking place, you know?
Well, actually, yeah, they're connected events. I mean, yeah. like Lovecraft came in almost directly after that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of that weird history because Houdini's priorities changed.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool. There's actually a little bit of overlap, but I mean, you know, you can't get everything in there.
Yeah. So yeah, that I thought was really interesting. And I thought it kind of spoke a lot to Meyer and Meyer's involvement and everything and his interests and how they intersect with this story of Houdini and his dad's interests, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So... any final thoughts on Houdini and how this fits into Meyer's overall body of work?
I have my problems with this thing, but they're kind of like production issues. And it's not like it is screwed up in any like, you know, fundamental way. It's just sort of like, I'm not sure if there is a way of doing this with this character that is particularly powerful. And like, part of it is like I said a little bit ago, Houdini is actually just not that broken a person. And as characters go, as figures for interesting like drama go, that's not particularly effective. And it's actually just kind of fun seeing Houdini's life and seeing his history. And the only problem that I have with it is it's actually kind of repetitive.
Yeah.
And the repetitive quality, like, on the one hand, I attribute to, like, you know, TV attention span attenuation. And on the other hand, I think, well, you know, it still actually feels kind of accurate as the psychoanalytic portrait point of view. It would be repetitive, and that's sort of the point. Like, you have to show a pattern by being repetitive in some way. And the only problem is that this particular pattern isn't particularly dramatic. It's just kind of neat.
Yeah.
It's just kind of neat. I mean, like, you come away from this thinking, like, you know, Houdini has problems, but I could actually hang out with that dude. He's a pretty nice guy.
Yeah.
I like that guy.
Yeah. For me, you know, I do think it's a good movie. I did have a couple problems with it as well, but they were all fairly minor. I think that the style is very interesting. Whether or not that was their original intention, I do think that it's cool and different and funky and weird and something that I think a lot of people are kind of scared to try. Like, I think the times when people tend to go to this style are associated with the times when people tend to deviate from the actual historical events.
Well, it's also very shark jumpy.
Yeah.
It feels like the point where they lost the plot.
Uh-huh.
But in many cases, it's also exactly what's needed.
Yeah.
If a different approach had been taken with this, it would have been wrong.
Mm-hmm. But I think as it stands, that it's pretty good, pretty solid, and I would definitely recommend it. In terms of like how it fits into Meyer's career, I mean, I think that it is kind of cool that you do see a lot of the same sort of topics and types of characters. You know, obviously he seems to be very interested in that part of history, but also like that type of person, you know, regardless of the time period or anything. There's an interesting thing where he approaches things from a psychoanalytic perspective a lot of the times, and I'm sure a lot of that has to do with, you know, his dad and everything, and also just sort of the idea of like taking historical characters and intersecting them with other historical characters, whether they're fictional or not. I mean, that's kind of an interesting idea, and you see that, you know, happening again and again in his stuff and here too, and I think that that's cool. And
doesn't it kind of seem like maybe at some point Meyer was criticized for having too many historical figures meet each other in his fiction? And he's like, okay, it straight up happens.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you like a bunch of real world examples, and it's going to take me 30 years, and then you're going to be like, well, it's weird. There actually are a lot of examples of that happening in real life.
Yeah. And I guess just my one final thought on it is, God, I wish that someone would just let him direct one of these scripts that he wrote. I know that, you know, he's talked about how he's not hot now and everything like that, but I wish something like Houdini would just blow up and then someone would be like, you know, Nicholas Meyer, I mean, like, God.
You mean blow up in the in the rap battle sense,
yeah.
Not the Hurt Locker one,
right? Exactly.
Okay.
And you know, I mean, like, I would love for someone like HBO to
someone like HBO,
some network like HBO or something like that
HBO
to give him, you know, a series, you know, like a True Detective type of series, and just be like, here, Nicholas Meyer, do whatever you want. You write it. You direct it. We will put it on the air, and it will be awesome. You know, I really wish we could get
it's
to that
HBO,
point.
It's HBO. It's not on air.
And one of the things which it is if you get it over satellite. And then one
I
of
guess, yeah.
One of the things which you know I thought about, and I had thought about this back a while ago, but this movie reminded me of it with, you know, the fact that it was executive produced by Gerald Abrams, JJ's dad. It's like, God, why couldn't JJ be like, you know, I'm working with Lawrence Kasdan right now. That's working out pretty well. What if, since I'm not doing Star Trek 13 or whatever, what if I were to just kind of hand this off to my dad's old buddy, Nicholas
We're going to need
Meyer.
To go to video at some point so that I can turn to an actual audience.
I'm just saying.
And roll my eyes, and they go like, hey, yeah, right.
I mean, wouldn't that be awesome? That would be so awesome.
Oh, that would be so awesome if the world was an entirely different place.
I'm just saying.
And the universe functioned by different rules.
Anyway,
you're living in a fantasy world, man.
Maybe.
There are no win scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
They exist.
Okay. All right. Well, it was fun talking about Nicholas Meyer and his new miniseries Houdini. But that's not all that we're talking about this week on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And, like, we were so busy, we didn't eat, like, all day. I had a Red Bull around 5 o'clock, right before the parsecs. I could feel my teeth, like, tingling.
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird.
Earl Grey.
He was robbing the bokle, as they say it in Klingon, as a Klingon word I just made up, just so you know.
I think we could tell.
The Orb.
What I also liked, too, was that Nog said, put that in there too, to Jake, and let people decide. And that just summed up DS9 for me, because DS9 is, you know, we're not going to tell you for sure he's a bad captain, even though obviously I think most people would agree that he was.
To the journey!
Oh yeah, B'Elanna's reading romantic fanfic.
Not everything is fanfic, okay? This
yes,
could
it
be
is.
A legitimate author with a legitimate publisher.
No, this is Klingon Harlequin. You know it is.
Warp 5.
The Orions, there's something really complex going on within their society, and there's a long-term struggle where the women have flipped the table on the men, and how does that all play out? And it's something where I wish Enterprise had gone for 7 seasons and they could have continued to revisit this and we find out more and more.
The Ready Room.
You know, people have seen that image. That image in particular, just that still of her with the Desilu logo over it, is really iconic. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what I discovered is it's not a still. It's probably 26 different stills.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
A number of scenes from especially the end of Into Darkness are sort of lifted and adapted from Wrath of Khan to be used in this story.
Lifted and Google translated into this version.
Literary Treks.
We all know Troy gets all the men that come on, the all the envoys, actually. You notice that she really likes these bad boy envoy men, you know?
She does.
Continuing mission.
How is Spock changing? How is he changed from the moment he met Captain Kirk from the non-mirror universe? What is his ultimate goal?
Axanar, the official podcast.
So basically, you've got this souped-up computer with this lens on the front of it. And because the resolution has increased so much with these cameras, the amount of data coming out of that camera is enormous.
And join us in welcoming aboard Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
I'm really, really glad that you mentioned Parliament Funkadelic. I could not watch this at all without thinking about George Clinton.
Yeah, so, just every time he talks about going to Parliament, I'm like, yeah.
Who wouldn't want to go?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream them from the website. Just visit Trek.fm. for podcast directory to get all the links. If you'd like to contact us, you could leave us a review on iTunes, or you could send us an email at comtrackstars@gmail.com.
Totally could.
Or you could also click the little button on the side of the page on trek.fm and send us a message that way.
It is within your power to do so.
Or you can hit us up on Twitter at comtrackstars, and we'd love to hear from you. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring commentary, Trek Stars, to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive and Federation and Spock's World, Audible has something for everyone. It's also got some of Nicholas Meyer's novels, things that we've covered earlier in the show, things like The 7% Solution, which was written by Meyer and is narrated by David Case. You can get the unabridged version, the whole 6 hours and 47 minutes of it.
It's awesome. Sherlock Holmes goes to rehab.
Yeah.
Oh, and someone does.
And you can get this book for free since you listen to Trek FM. Here's the summary. This rediscovered Sherlock Holmes adventure recounts the unique collaboration of Holmes and Sigmund Freud in the solution of a mystery on which the lives of millions may depend.
Word for word, but I said earlier.
Yeah, and like we said, you can get it for free on Audible. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. And lastly, if you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find another way in which you can help us out, and that is by donating to the show to help keep it on the air, to the network, I should say. Patreon, from what I gather, is kind of like Kickstarter, but for like sort of a monthly subscription thing. And just like Kickstarter, there's certain rewards for donating. They got some cool things.
It's Kick Continuer.
Yeah. Kick Continuer. Yes.
Try saying that 17 times fast for like, a small fee
yeah,
every month.
They've got different levels. I mean, you know, you can give just a dollar to show support or whatever. Or, you know, I mean, there's some good stuff for a minimal amount of donation. Like, for $2, you get access to exclusive content on our Patreon channel.
Yeah.
Where you can hear us do who knows what, other shows.
Yeah.
Outtakes.
Stuff that we're going to totally get around to doing.
Yeah, I've got some ideas.
Good ideas.
I've got some other ideas.
So good ideas?
Well, I was thinking, like, maybe we could do, like, some sort of pilot episodes for
better ideas than things we wouldn't do.
Yes.
Worse ideas than things we're already doing.
Yes.
All right.
Something like that. So help us out. Go to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron.
Or a Patreon.
Yes.
Patreonize us.
Well, that's about it for our look at Nicholas Meyer and his work on Houdini. We will be back next week with Larry Nemechek to discuss Robert Wise and his work on Star Trek The Motion Picture.